Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 72 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday, Larry. How are you?
Doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I appreciate you joining. Can I introduce you to a new word this week?
I can't wait.
You can't wait. It's cacistocracy. Excuse me. I didn't say that right. It's cacistocracy. I messed it up. Cacistocracy. Can you imagine what this word would possibly mean?
I've never heard it before.
And we will move right on after I give this definition. But it is a system of government that is run by the worst, least qualified, and most unscrupulous citizens. I don't know. The word just showed up, someone sent it to me, and it just seemed to resonate, and I liked it.
It has a nice ring to it. I've never heard it before, so I'll try to remember that.
Please do. Try to use that in a sentence just randomly.
That's kind of like the medulla oblongata or whatever it was.
The medulla oblongata, which is the little nut-sized piece of your brain that's the fight or flight part of your brain.
Mm-hmm. I certainly can remember that one. That'll be at the tip of my tongue tomorrow.
I was talking to one of our listeners. He regularly sends us questions, and he said that there was a bill that was moving in through Tennessee that is going to increase. I don't know if it was residency, work, or presence restrictions. I'm not sure how Tennessee is set up, but he said they're going to increase the restrictions from 1,000 to 2,000 feet. And the reason that they are doing this is to keep there from being mass migrations of registrants from a stricter state to a more lenient state.
I'm familiar with the concept.
And he was happy to share with me. He said he was going to channel his inner Larry. And he said, what's the problem? We can't have these predators invading our borders. The only reasonable thing to do is make our laws less desirable than Alabama's. And by golly, that's what we're going to do. Does that sound like you?
That would certainly be a position of some lawmakers in Tennessee. They would say that when people move to other states, they unfortunately say things they should not say. And when they ask them what brought you here, there's this desire to be honest because honesty is the best policy. And they say, well, it's bad in Alabama. Oh, yeah. What way? Oh, well, we have to do blah, 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 blah. And then that gets all documented. And then that's taken to Nashville the next time the legislature. And they say, well, the last year we've had 67 people move here from Alabama. And then they may have, you know, from other states, but whatever those common states would imagine be the bordering states that are in Tennessee and around Tennessee, the ones that are tougher than Tennessee, people would tend to gravitate to there. And same thing could happen to Georgia, but that's not an uncommon reaction for people. Right. People don't want an invasion. I mean, we hear that from the White House.
Yeah, I don't know. This has just all been an evolution of my understanding that you think that we're the United States and we just sort of have like one set of laws, but that is like so far from the truth that each state gets to do not all that they want to do, but they can do what they want to do.
Do what they can do, the things that are not exclusively within the federal domain.
Yeah.
That's a lot of things.
We did get an email message from JP, no idea, but he says, my town is all abuzz via Facebook about this sex offender, Shriek, who got out of Vermont State Prison last week and is now moving to my town after two false starts in neighboring towns. The police in particular have been plastering social media with warnings. Everybody seems to be talking about it. It seems nobody wants him. Huh. I reviewed basic info about him, and he served 30 years for assault, burglary, and rape. He committed over not-so-wonderful summer when he was 18 years old in 1987. No question this guy was despicable. But after 30 years, is this the best way to keep him from reoffending? What is of note is that A, he was 18 when he committed the crimes. Nobody died, that's B, nobody died, yet he was given 22 to 50 years. He pled no low, so he didn't put up a fight in court. Again, WTF, I don't know what WRT means, 22 to 55 years. And he didn't harm kids, yet all of the public hysteria about a kid effing pervert getting released into our community. I think it's a good example of how the term sex offender is like a Rorschach test as well as how the police use social media to create hysteria. FYP. So there you go. That's just a comment email that we received during the week.
And again, if we didn't have a sex offender registry, this wouldn't be happening, would it?
I guess not. I mean, he did commit a crime, but it's the public side of it. I mean, if we had a Leo registry, would that be not it wouldn't solve the whole problem, but wouldn't that make it kind of mostly go away?
It would diminish there's leakage with law enforcement only registration. There's leakage because of various things of law enforcement making visits to check. So there's still leakage with those registries, but it would be a significant improvement. But if we took any paroled offender, and that's a person who received an indeterminate period of time like that one apparently got 22 to 50, if we went out and put their name on a list and announced to the community that we're putting this whatever type of offender in the community, we would have emotional reactions, maybe not to the same decibel level that we're having with this, but there would be an emotional reaction because we're putting a X, you can't name it, offender, a drug offender or whatever right. offender, you know, a gang offender. If you started relocating them and announcing it publicly, you would get an adverse reaction. If yes. we didn't have the sex offender registry, all the people out there who think the registry is not so bad, and we've got people that are on the registry that say it's not that bad, that they've acclimated to it. If all the people out there think it's not so bad, this is what it causes.
And then there would probably be some sort of way to, this was going on in Oregon, we covered this maybe like 6 months ago, where someone would file some FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act, to get information released so they could get the information and publish it on their own.
They're doing that, and states are doing that, and even sheriff's departments in states are doing that, where Arkansas comes to mind first off the top of my head, that they have that risk-based system where they don't put the ones and twos on the internet. But the sheriffs are saying, well, nothing says we can't have our own website of sexual offenders. By golly, I'm going to put everybody that's in my county to keep my citizens safe. I'm going to put them out there as a public service. And so you end up with I think there's a cause of action there that would possibly gain legs. But, you know, there hasn't been the funding materialized to do it. But yeah, there's these ways where you have leakage even with a law enforcement registry. Those are theoretically on a law enforcement only registry. But when the sheriff goes ahead and illuminates them, that's no longer law enforcement only.
I will tell you this. I was having a conversation with someone and I shared that we do this podcast, and the person was saying, there's that much to talk about on a weekly basis regarding the registry. And I was like, you have no idea how often there's all this scope creep or people doing these horrible things. Or did you see the video of the kid getting body slammed in the school parking lot by a resource officer?
Recent one that happens regularly.
I know. This was I think it was a recent one. I was just scrolling through Twitter and I saw some large, burly, uniformed person like pick up a kid, look like WWF wrestling or whatever, and then throw a kid down on the ground. Anyway, I was just sharing. I was like, yeah, there's enough stuff to go to cover about our criminal justice system and our overzealous police force. Yes,
well,
we have plenty to talk about.
I don't see a problem with that. So far tonight,
it's no problem to increase restrictions from 1,000 to 2,000 feet, and it's okay to body slam children on the school property.
I don't see a problem with it. I mean, they need to follow the commands of the officer. And these officers go out there and put their lives on the line. They don't know if they're coming home to their families. And if they're in a school and there's someone being disobedient, why wouldn't they be able to body slam them? I mean. The problem we have in this country is too many bleeding hearts that are making excuses for disobedience.
Right. Well, then I guess we should just dive right into the articles before things get really depressing, right?
Well, what was the direction you want to go in the Tennessee? The expansion of that. It's one of those things where the Tennessee people are going to have to rise to the challenge, and they're going to have to engage in the discussion, and if they sit back silently, the odds are a whole lot better that it'll be passed. They need to come explain why this is bad public policy.
Literally the intent of this podcast is to slowly drip feed people the ideas, the attitudes, the inspiration to somehow end up at your state capitol, talking to your local representative, whatever, to do something, whatever those somethings are, to modify our situation. That is like the broadest spectrum. That is what this podcast is for.
Well, you've got two options. You can sit back and hope that that people don't dream up new laws and expansions of existing laws and hope that that works out for you. And then you can send a list to us of the states where that's worked out, where hope alone has kept things at bay. Or you can figure out how to engage in the process, learn the process, and engage at whatever level you're capable of doing and try to push back. And we've got too many people who feel like that they are entitled to be saved. Ideally, I guess you would be. You could feel that way. But there's not a lot of advocacy for people convicted of sex offenses. If you're not there in Nashville, I can't think possibly the Civil Liberties Union might be there. There might be some defense lawyers that I know our association is there when we're in session. The Defense Lawyers Association is there. But largely, there's going to be no one there. And they're only hearing the advocates for this. That's all they're hearing from. When they look around the room and say, is anyone opposed to this? There's nothing. Yeah. So what are they supposed to do? When something's not controversial, it increases the odds it's going to pass.
Without a doubt. I know you have no information, like off the cuff, what could they do getting to the state capitol? What could they do in this regard to somehow derail it, slow it down, anything?
Well, that's a podcast to itself. I mean, they would have to get into the minutia of how the bills are moved through the process in Tennessee. They got to figure out if it's a House bill, if it's a Senate bill, or if there's one in each chamber identical. And then they've got to figure out what committee it's in, and they've got to figure out who the key players are on that committee. In Tennessee, I can guarantee the Republicans are running the show. So you need to cozy up to the Republicans because they're in the majority, probably a very solid majority. In Tennessee, and you try to appeal to whatever you've got, and what you've got in a case of that is that the most cogent argument is it's going to push more sex. Republicans are going to be more likely to represent rural areas. The urban areas are going to be more likely to be Democrats. So what you tell a conservative Republican is, well, what's going to happen? This sounds real good, but what's going to happen is that we're going to end up with people being pushed out of the urban cities into rural areas, because when you start drawing 2,000-foot circumference around things, there's a whole lot more things in Shelby County that you can that so you we're going to end up with Shelby County sex offenders over here. And they say, huh, I didn't ever think of that. So the urban right. sex offender is going to be pushed out to a rural area if we expand the exclusion zones, and that gives them pause for thought. But if you don't tell them that, they're not going to magically think of that on their own. They're going to hear what law enforcement is telling them is that we've got an inundation of sex offenders coming from Alabama and other states where they're tougher, and we need to get tougher so that they quit coming here. That's all they're going to be considering if that's all they're told.
And Brenda in chat says that showing them maps totally shut down that bill in Maryland. And isn't that what Paul Dubling showed at the conference, where like laid a map out and drew big circles about, hey, people can't go here, can't go to the mall and buy shoes because there's a daycare at the mall, or things of that nature?
That is precisely what he did. So.
So there's some ideas for you Tennessee folks on how to step up and do that. Oh, one other thing. So if you were under the most of strict conditions in your state, you have done the most horrible things, and you are just shy of on house arrest, would you still go to the state capitol and do these things, say that you have a right to redress your grievances? How would you approach that angle?
Well, I mean, depending on what type of – if you're just simply on the registry, you have basically undiminished – should have the basic undiminished liberty rights. As you tighten that noose in terms of house arrest, I mean, your house arrest is very restrictive. You can't leave your house without authorization. But I wouldn't want to advocate that anybody do my plan. But I would assert that if I'm merely required to register, I've got a right to be anywhere. You've got to particularly to petition the government for redress of grievance. I would say people that are supervised have that same right. Try to effectuate that right. I just pulled up the Tennessee General Assembly just for kicks and giggles, and it's lopsided, very lopsided. The House has 73 Republicans and 26 Democrats, so it's a 3-to-1 majority. I mean, they've got veto proof supermajority, and
right.
The Senate. It has 27 Republicans and 5 Democrats. So the Democrats basically don't exist in the Tennessee Senate.
Okay. So unless you can get a hold of the conservatives, you're going to have a hard time doing anything.
Well, that's who you're going to have to get through to. The Democrats can't affect policy at all in Tennessee.
Very good.
Yeah. It's kind of like the reverse of California. Republicans have very little influence and impact on California politics. The Democrats have no say-so on what goes on in Tennessee.
Sure. All right, then. Well, here's an article out of CBS News, and it says, a new study finds some boys are having sex before age 13. I think I also saw something go by that talked about criminalizing this behavior to some degree. You're just going to, like, make everybody that has sex outside of marriage a registrant to some degree. This is the kids are maturing faster. They are experimenting sooner, and they've experimented forever. I'm a little puzzled by what we want society to do. We can't go the abstinence route. That would probably be ideal, but that's not reality.
Well, lock them up.
We could put them all on the registry, and then if everybody's on the registry, then nobody's on the registry. It doesn't matter.
You're old enough to do an adult crime. You're old enough to do the time. So if you're going to fool around having sex at 13 years old, you ought to be treated as an adult, locked up, and get on with it. So next story.
There is a trending news item in this article. It says consent condoms require 4 hands to open, and that intrigues me just on its own. But this then breaks it down even a little bit further and talks about some racial disparities that the black and the Hispanic kids are way ahead of the white kids, which I'm not sure the significance behind it, but it's there.
It was an interesting read to me. That I mean, it's of course people have been experimenting, but I would have to believe that since we are so obsessed with our kids having the smartest phones that money can buy, they'll do everything, and probably not monitoring them adequately, and plus unmonitored computer access. I would have to imagine that the temptation and the stimuli that are available to a teenager growing up today would be far more than what we would have had. In our day, you'd been looking under the mattress trying to find something when parents weren't home. You don't have to look under mattresses anymore. You just use the mouse or you use your phone.
Yes.
And so I suspect that they're being stimulated, and their little minds are wondering even more than what we were in our day when we were had hormone rages, but we didn't have all the stimuli around us.
Fair enough.
That argues for locking them up, though, doesn't it?
I think we should, if you have any of these desires, if you watch a Britney Spears, and I'm dating myself by saying that, and she looks hot, then you should go to prison. There you go. Done. Problem solved.
In 2 national surveys, investigators found that between 4 and 8% of boys reported having sex before reaching age 13.
Do you think that there's an argument that kids back in the day were more hands-on instead of just watching the porn and getting aroused that way? Or do you think it was just they weren't having sex at all?
Certainly having sex and experimenting, but I don't think we had the sensitivity that we have to it now. You know, everybody is really keenly aware of more about sex. I know I fooled around a little bit in my day when there
what?
Was lax adult supervision supervision is in many cases tighter because of the electronic way we can supervise. you can be at work and you can monitor what your kids are doing.
stay-at-home mom, though. I mean, and forgive me, I don't mean to sound misogynistic or anything, but, you know, 20, 30, 50 years ago, mom was at home every day and dad went off to work. So there was, generally speaking, someone home when you got home from school, kind of sort of preventing you from having an opportunity.
I was going to say, but with electronic means, we can with nanny cams, all the stuff, where you can monitor your kids remotely. So
yeah, there's a really good security camera out there for $20. You can watch all kinds of stuff.
But it is interesting that the ratio in San Francisco was so much lower than Memphis, where the Bible Belt is so strong. But 25% of the boys in Memphis reported it, and only 5% of the boys in San Francisco.
All right. Let's move on to an article from Vox, and I totally, totally want your take on this, and I don't care to get into the politics of it, but Bernie Sanders wants to expand voting rights by letting people in prison vote. Only two states, including Sanders' home state of Vermont, currently allow people to vote from prison. What are your thoughts on people actually incarcerated behind the walls about allowing them to vote?
I don't really have a strong feeling on it one way or the other. I don't think it would alter the elections meaningfully. I think, if anything, it would probably add a more conservative tilt to the election than what we already have. There's arguments for it. There's arguments against it. The arguments for it are that you want to mimic the out. You know, I've said on this podcast, we want to make prison resemble the outside as much as possible so that it's less traumatic to reintegrate into society. We want to mimic in the free world. This would be another thing that you could do that would mimic life in the free world. Right. There's the other argument that people make that, by God, you've done something wrong, and you don't get to participate in society fully and decide. I mean, when you voted, you're effectively voting for taxes and against taxes and for referendums and whatnot. Those are a strong argument that you shouldn't have that right until you've paid your debt to society. But I don't think it's going to meaningfully alter the outcome. Like I say, if I think anything's going to happen, it's going to bend the voting more toward the right. And I think we're getting data out of Florida showing that.
Yeah, it seems kind of unfair that, granted, you did something to put yourself inside, and now all of the laws could change to make life worse for you. But now that you're behind, you have no say in how those things change.
Yep, that's a compelling argument. But on the other hand, say, for example, a prison's located in a small town, just hypothetically, that the town has a population of 300, and they put it out in the middle of nowhere, and you've got 500 prisoners in there, and they get to vote. They get to vote on the politics of the town.
Yep. Yep. And doesn't that sway the census data, like inside the state, that, hey, now there's 3,000 people that live in that town, and that gives them more election power in the state?
It very much does, because they're counted where they're living. They take correctional census data on census day on April 1st. Next year, they'll count to people that are incarcerated.
And what's the argument from D.C.'s point of view, that a taxation without representation? I mean, isn't that what that is to the utmost extreme?
Well, what taxation are you paying when you're in prison?
Well, no, but I mean, just like the whole concept is all of the things, but you can't have a say in it. But they're doing all the, they're getting more funding for schools. They're doing all these things because you are quote unquote living there, but you don't have a say in anything at all.
Oh, I see where you're coming from. So you got half the town that's not able to vote.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just sort of speaking off the cuff of what it would appear to me to be. And that sounds, I mean, the way the Constitution was written, the South wanted to have certain people counted but not be able to vote. So they were counted as 3/5 of a human, but they counted on the census, but they couldn't vote. But the population was counted.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think we're ready for that. Yeah. We're still fighting to restore people after they've done their debt to society and paid their debt.
Right, no doubt.
I think that if anything, that is a platform. If it gets into a platform plank in the Democratic Party, it'll seem more of a radical position, and it'll be used to say this is how radical those people are, and it'll be used as a demonizing. You see it coming. If the Democratic Party would have put that in a national platform in 2020, you'd hear a lot of demonization about, oh, they want to have people in prison voting. They're so desperate to win votes that they're giving the vote to the convicts. And of course, I don't believe I don't believe the votes would go that way. I believe the votes would be equally divided, or more so going towards the conservatives. But that's not what they would say.
Well, I would point out, definitely take a look at the show notes and grab the link to the Vox article that is in there, because we do get asked on a halfway regular basis, oh, well, what do you want me to do? I can't vote, blah, blah, blah. Well, depending on which state you're in, you very well may vote, be able to vote. So it may not be that you can't vote. You just don't know you can.
Well, in the overwhelming majority of the states, if you've paid your debt to society, you can vote.
Right. And only in places like Florida where they you know, they've carved our people out, aren't allowed to vote.
So, but yeah, the overwhelming majority of the people who fully discharge their obligations can vote. And it's a small number of states where you still continue to have the disenfranchisement. And some people can even vote when they're on supervision. States have, I think there's a chart in that story that shows.
There is.
Yeah.
That's what, I was telling. So go check out the map. There's a like a hyperlink map to where you can get the information about your specific state. And there are only a handful of states, five-ish or so, counting kind of quick six or seven states, that some people with criminal convictions can't vote, Florida being one of those. But the vast majority are of like a light blue color where they can, prisoners and parolees and probationers can't vote. So that would be after your sentence is over, prisoners and parolees can't vote. Prisoners can't vote. Everyone can vote. So, you know, it breaks it up for you to where you can see where you're coming from and if you're allowed to vote or not. Let's move across the pond to the Brisbane Times. This is over in New Zealand, I suppose. Child protection advocate labels sex offender register a waste of money. I certainly wish we had like an audio clip of this one, because I like the way they talk down under. And that's not really down under, but sort of down under and then over.
I think this is out of Australia.
That what it is? Well, all right, fine then.
So
Australia, nonetheless. Then it is down under. Yep. And really, I didn't even want to stick here for very long, but what this representative, independent state candidate, Hetty Johnston, wants a mandatory two-strike policy. She says, like, the registry doesn't make any sort of sense. If you do mess up again, it's over, life in prison. But the first go-around... Hey, look, most of the people are one-time offenders, and then they move on and they figure out that they've made a mistake. So let's not spend a whole bunch of money on this idea of a registry. I think she says, so we're going to spend $8 million. I'm not sure why we're spending it on something that does not, or excuse me, why we're not spending it on something that does work. I don't know. Just wanted to bring it up to show that there are people out there. Granted, this is in another country, but there are people out there that are seeing the light that the registry is kind of pointless.
Yes, and this is one of those things where you know, it sounds really good that she's against the registry, but she's also a hardliner. So in all other regards, you would disagree with her probably.
Because right, that could be true. Yeah, sure.
Two strikes, you're out. To me, is archaic thinking. So she's one of those where. Your heart begins to palpitate because she says one thing that you like. It's kind of like our syndicated columnist is based in Albuquerque, which I won't say her name, but once out of every 20 columns, she writes something very good. But she's a victim's advocate. She's strong victim's advocate. She's for abolishing the statute of limitations. She's for doing everything that would make anybody. But then she'll like the broken clock twice a day. It does something right. It gets the time correct. She'll write something that makes sense, and people just start going bananas about, oh, she said wonderful things. Yeah. But in the meantime, she's trying to do all these bad things that are bad public policy. And, well, that's the same thing with this. This elected official would probably not be someone you'd want to align yourself with, except for on this one issue.
Right. We should all be single issue voters, man. We should all be single issue voters.
Yeah, if she's willing to say that the registry is no good, you align yourself with this, and then you run quickly as you can away from this person, because most everything else you're going to disagree on.
Yeah. Moving on to an article from MCall. The Morning Call is what it actually is. Morningcall.com. Backpage is gone, but a more graphic version is again fueling prostitution busts in the Lehigh Valley. This is just fascinating to me. I still don't quite understand why we have such an aversion to people making money by some means that they want to make it by. So our government created a FOSTA-CESTA, I guess is what it is. It's the to prevent sex trafficking stuff. So that made Craigslist take down their personals, and then there's this website called Backpage. Here's this other one. This is hosted in another country. And you can find people in your neighborhood that are willing to go to lunch or maybe do more than just lunch, maybe massages, you know, fill in the gap. And the law enforcement people are kind of up in arms because this is just like prostitution right in their face. And it's, you know, I guess they'd have to make the contact and do all the things to set up a meet to get you in a position to arrest you. But I just really, really dislike this whole mentality of criminalizing everything sexual in the United States.
Well, the president that we have now signed the legislation, a pair of laws back in last April, a year ago.
Yeah.
Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act and Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. And those things resulted in the government seizing Backpage. There's going to be a demand for sexual services. I'm quite confident for the remainder of my time and probably beyond. And the beautiful thing about capitalism is it finds a way to supply services when there's a demand for it. So this new site, that's what is it? Skip the Games.
It's called Skip the Games.
has sprung up, and of course it would spring up. What would keep it from springing up?
We are a capitalistic society, right?
We are, but we've got a very heavy presence of morality about sex. You know, we just can't have that. People doing that things. You know, if sex is for creating offspring and for procreation. It's not. People ought not be going out lightly engaging in sexual relations. That's crazy, Andy.
It sure does feel good, man.
Well, that's not what. That's not why sex exists.
Oh. I bet if it hurt, there would be a lot less of it. So I'm pretty sure that if somehow things were designed in a different way, there would be a lot less of it. You cannot criminalize this. And the more you criminalize it, the more underground it goes, then the more risk there would be associated with it, the more potential disease spreading that would go along with it. Abuse and violence and sex trafficking and all that. I just can't quite fathom why we can't be more like Vegas. And what county is that? I can't think of which county it is that allows it in Nevada. But I just don't quite get it. Regulate it and all that.
Well, and the funny thing is they have the statistics in there. You know, it's a long read article, but from the Pennsylvania Uniform Crime Reporting System, the prostitution and commercialized vice arrests have gone down dramatically from 106 in 2014 to 28 in 2018. So this appears to be a solution in search of a problem.
Right. Right.
They're spending all
this. We didn't stomp out all of it, so we have to get that last little nugget.
So I don't understand it, but I think it has to do with a lot of our religious influences. A lot of this is related to Bible teachings and views about the appropriateness of sexuality. And Americans are pretty much, if you look at westernized countries, there's a lot more. The other Western nations laugh at us. They actually laugh at us in terms of our attitudes about sex. They don't understand where we're coming from. And I used to house students from all over the world when I was in property management. And when the Germans and French said, what the hell's wrong with you people? so it's like, but it is, that's the way it is.
I do. Let me ask you this question. So there's a line in the article. It says on the website, Skip the Games only provides an email for police to contact them. You're a pretty savvy person in regard to the police. Do you think you could thwart their attempts to capture you, to expose you and get you arrested? Do you think that you could pull that off?
Probably not.
You think that somebody would slip through your screening process to end up getting you in trouble?
Well, how would you be able to ferret out by email? What would make that a potent screening tool?
I thought if you asked somebody if they were a police officer, they had to tell you that they were.
Where did that come from?
I've seen that in movies. I'm totally not being serious on that one. Well, I mean,
Like I said, you're pretty savvy. Do you think that you could screen them? Do you think that you could, get enough information out of getting a picture? You could see how their haircut is. That would be something that would tell you. I don't know. I was just curious if you had any ideas.
I don't think so. I don't think that you could. Obviously, they're not succeeding because people are getting busted. But I don't think you could. The cops go various forms of undercover, and they're quite good at portraying a character of a person that doesn't exist. And I don't think I'd be sophisticated enough to ferret it out. It's just sad that we spend resources trying to stop something like this. I would think we would want people to be engaging in this. To me, it's healthy.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Isn't consensual sexual relations what we're after? Aren't we trying to get rid of the illegal? I thought that's what we were trying to fight, was the illegal sexual behavior.
Hey, let me tell you this story. So while I was in one of the treatments, I can't remember if it, I think it was while I was still gone, and I was reading a men's health article, and there was something that like listed some pretty extreme number of positive health benefits to sex. And I brought this up in class, and then the facilitator, the teacher, whatever you want to call it, was like almost appalled at me bringing up that sex was anything of a good thing. And stress relief, all the endorphins, just like this whole multitude of positive biological things that would happen from, and it was like, I'm so offended by this.
Not surprised.
Yep. How about we cover an article from the New York Times about a Supreme Court do-over? And we've talked about this a little. I mean, we haven't really dug too deep, and I don't really necessarily want to rehash it. But the recent Supreme Court decisions regarding executions and people that are claiming to have either differences of religions and then wanting to have their religious leader in there, or people that are having these medical conditions that would make the standard way of doing the execution incredibly painful. And the Supreme Court has been woefully inconsistent in their rulings, allowing some, not allowing others, in what would on the surface sort of seem like the situations are very similar, if not identical. And I'm really puzzled by this one, and I'm kind of angry about it. People do horrible things, and we then sentence them to death, and I can't really see why we would then go, nope, sorry, you either get to die in extreme punishment, or your religious leader can't be there at your side. I just can't see why we are such assholes about this particular subject.
Well, it looks like on the death, the religious leaders, it looks like that the timeliness was what they hung their hat on, was that the one where they denied the stay was submitted only 10 days or so or 5 days before.
Right.
And then the other one where they granted the stay out of Texas, there was a lot more advance notice. I guess what the Supreme Court might be saying is that we're not sympathetic to last minute requests. They may be trying to convey that last minute request, if you're at death's door, you might as well plan to go through.
Isn't that punting it kind of sort of?
Well, not really. I mean, we want finality. And so if you're trying to establish that last minute maneuvers are not going to be well taken, there's a danger in that. But they want finality, right? I mean, you've been on death row 12 years now,
right?
Well,
so
okay.
Get it over with, like hurry up and.
Well, yeah, you had 12 years to figure out how you wanted to die with your religious leader. This is not my personal view, but I think that's how they're coming to their decision on the block of the conservatives who are saying, I mean, Kagan and the liberals dissented in that, but the
yes.
They're saying that we need finality and closure, and these last minute appeals are not going to be well received.
Just not really happy by that stance. And me being a non-religious person, by golly, man, if somebody wants to have that religious person there by their side as they go out, I can't figure out why we wouldn't let that happen.
And then the painless one, I mean, to me, that one's very explainable. Uh-huh. Because the cruel and unusual clause does not mean
that
we need to take all the evolving standards of decency. A lot of stuff that we would not tolerate today was tolerated back in those days. And if you're a literalist, if you cling to that belief that we need to interpret it exactly how those words would have meant at the time, it's easy to get to the conclusion that they came to.
Sure.
It's not cruel and unusual as colonial times would have viewed cruel and unusual. We're talking about contemporary times, but in colonial times, this would not have been viewed. For you to experience pain at an execution would not have, in and of itself, been viewed as cruel and unusual. Now, if they let you let someone gather around you and do a thousand stabs in colonial times to watch you slowly die, that would have probably been considered cruel and unusual. But you weren't. All the executions that they did were not painless in colonial times. So, therefore, how can you say pain is going to be cruel and unusual? It's not, unless you believe in that mumbo jumbo about a evolving standards.
And you know, we've had Gorsuch for a couple years now, and there have been a handful of times where he has come out and said. Something to the effect of, if the legislators wanted it to be that way, then they would have written it that way. It is not my job to put words in their mouth and say what they didn't say, which to me then kicks it back to the state where we have the most representation at the state and more local levels, less so than at the federal level. Okay, so then it's back on we could have controlled this if we wanted it to happen. I still come back to we're assholes.
Yes.
I don't know any other way to put it. I just don't.
But people do the flip-flop on what if it's something where they don't agree, they would like for a judicial intervention to create public policy that they would agree with. And then when you flip that over the other way around, then they get angry about judicial intervention. If it's something that they've supported that's been enacted through the public policy, they get furious that the black robes come in and disallow that. But it's not – if you are a textualist and you believe that a judge's job is merely to interpret the text of the statute and keep it and keep in mind that they can't trample the Constitution – it's not the judge's job to figure out what would have been a better way to do something. That's not for them to say, well, you know, I reckon maybe they've got the driving age at 16, but all the data I can see says that they can drive just as safe at 15, so I'm going to arbitrarily change the law to 15. That's not their role. Maybe it would be a good idea if we let people drive at 15, but that's not their role to do that. That's your role to do that.
Right. And my point in that, and to me, this I find this to be empowering, and probably other people be like, oh, we're doomed. But I'm trying to convey that it is on us, the individuals, the 30 million of us, that we can go make these changes. Not that it's easy, but we have that power to make this what we want. And as it stands, we have decided to make it what we want. And I don't like what that is.
So, well, we're one of the family of nations where the government is exactly what we say it is.
Right.
The countries around the world where there's authoritarian regimes imposed on them, our government has the powers that we provided. Nothing happens in this country that we haven't authorized. The fact that we're in 100 countries in the world with military presence, that's because we've allowed that expenditure and we've authorized that. You know, the fact that you go through a strip search at the airport where they take images of your intimate parts, that's because we allow that.
Right.
We have the government and we have what we are willing to tolerate. We empower the actions to be taken in our name. The government is us. It's not something that the interplanetary galactic forces imposed on us. It's what we've chosen to impose on ourselves.
Let's see if I can word this way. We have won the ovarian lottery to be born in the United States into a governmental system that we can alter, modify, you know, we have influence over. And a large number of us in the United States do nothing to do so.
I would be a little stronger to say that we not only can alter or modify, we have a complete control. I mean, other than trampling the Constitution, you know, there are certain things we cannot do that we shouldn't put up for vote because the Constitution, unless we go through the process of amending it, does not allow certain things. But beyond what's not within the scope of constitutionality, we can do anything we want to do.
Right. Right. And the only thing that I in that is, in the grand scheme of things, one vote can matter. Generally, it doesn't matter. So, but find a way to enlarge your sphere of influence to get more people to vote in your camp. However you do that, you do many great things in your state because you have established you have built the framework around the foundation for you to be able to do that. And we could do collectively more of those things. And other people do it against us or, you know, in different areas, you know, maybe there's some tow truck bill coming down the pike that you need to deal with in some form or fashion.
I've heard of a tow truck bill.
Yeah. Who'd have thunk, right? I'm going to bounce us back to this YouTube article. I didn't have it loaded, but I don't want to play it either. But I received a link to a YouTube video, so I would like you guys to go check it out in the show notes. And it is an individual. The YouTube channel is called Common Sense Laws. And there's, I don't know, a dozen or so videos in there, but the one that's linked in the show notes is it's called A Fresh Look at International Megan's Law. I think it's 9 minutes long. And I thought the guy did a pretty decent job, as good as I've heard anybody explain who's affected and all that. And I totally wanted your take on the accuracy of what he's saying is going on.
As from what I know, it seemed accurate as far as I can tell.
There was a little bit of a part in there that he maybe going a little bit extreme on the barking side of it and the history of that with Germany. Do you have any thought, an opinion on that side of it?
Not really so much, but he spent time about who's eligible for a passport and the
right.
Belief that people are not eligible to get passports, and he didn't. Unless I was dreaming, he didn't go into a whole lot about the marking, did he? In terms of Did he thoroughly cover the?
He showed a picture of it, and you know it says this individual has been convicted of a crime with a minor, you know, whatever the actual verbiage is. He's in the country of Germany, and he portrayed this whole thing about Germans, and they have a history of marking a certain segment of the population's documents and then doing horrible things with those people. And Germany is looking at the United States and marking passports and with a very skeptical eye of similarity to something that happened in the 40s and 30s.
I was working and I had it going in the background, so I didn't actually see the marking that he showed. I was listening.
Yeah,
to
he
it.
Totally showed it. It's maybe around the 6 minute mark or so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of zooming around to look for it. It is at 4:49 that you can see it if you want to, have a look. I don't know. He wasn't screaming. He wasn't jumping around. It seemed very factual from all the information that I've collected over the years about IML and all that. So give it a shot. If you want to just search for the YouTube channel, Common Sense Laws. And I don't know. Maybe check out some of his other videos to go with it.
Sounds good to me, Andy.
Cool. All right. So where are we at in the roster? Oh, Larry. Oh, my God. This guy did not register his car. This is in Georgia. This isn't terribly far from me, I think.
This is in Illinois. It's in DeKalb.
Why do they have the same? I saw DeKalb County. I was like, oh man, this loser's in Georgia. He didn't register his car, and he got 30 months, 2 to 5 years in prison for not registering his car.
Well, I thought he had been arrested. I didn't know he's gone through the process yet.
He could face probation or 2 to 5 years in prison for not registering his car.
Well,
this is lunacy, man.
Well, this is, but again, if we didn't have the sex offender registry, this would not be happening. But what happens is they staff these units because this should actually not be in the hands of law enforcement since it's a civil regulatory scheme. But this is pitfall number one by having it in the hands of law enforcement. But then the law enforcement staffs up a particularized, specialized unit that deals with this, and they need to make cases to justify their existence. If you have five detectives assigned to a specialized unit and there are absolutely no cases ever being made, at some point the bean counters would say, well, there's not really, I mean, in our burglary unit, we're getting 178 filings a year And in our sex offender registration tracking unit, we haven't had a filing in 4 years. So maybe we should put more of these people in the burglary unit where we've got, or the auto theft unit, or blah, blah, blah. And so they're under pressure to generate cases. And
yeah,
the fact of the matter is, when you buy a car, I don't know of a state that doesn't register them. So there's a pretty good track record on car sales. We keep those from dealerships. And that's one of the things you're not going to have a lot of leeway on. You're just not, because there's too many documents. There's too many moving parts that are documenting that transaction. But it shows the lack of – there's no reason in the world why you couldn't go online and put in that VIN number. And if the motivation is to have that available to the public so that they can protect themselves from that car lurking in the community, you would want it to get into the system as fast as possible, which means right. that you would want an electronic. If a person is carrying any type of phone, even my phone, I can make a picture of. So you have.
And you have like a $20 Walmart special or something.
You have a electronic portal where they go online and they put their ID number in and they put the VIN number and they put a picture of that car in, and it's registered with the law enforcement right away. But that's not why they do this. They do all these things so they can play I gotcha. Because if you have
you totally
all these
think
things,
this is an entrapment kind of
it's not
test?
An entrapment. It's an I gotcha. If we make enough restrictions in the course of a day, you're eventually going to violate. If I want to get rid of you on a job, right. and I want to put the manpower and the resources into tracking you over the course of a couple of weeks, I can fire you. You're going to screw up enough times in the course of a month that I can fire you. If right. you put right. enough restrictions on offenders that have to register about things they have to do, bureaucratic requirements, you'll eventually have an I got you moment. And that's what this is.
And just like you said, so the guy bought the car. And there is, if he bought it new, then there's certainly dealership, and then there's tax records behind it. And even still, if you bought it from an individual, then you have some period of time to pony up the tax money and get it registered and all that. Yeah. So why couldn't they just literally pass the information over to the other agency?
Well, why wouldn't you want, if this information is so valuable that we need to have it as current as it can be, why wouldn't you want an offender to be able to report everything online that's required to be reported? We passed that law in 2013 here, that the state was supposed to create an electronic mechanism for you to report things. Now, the state has ignored the law under the previous governor, and we're going to try to get this governor to actually follow the law. You know, they put the hand on that Bible and said that they were going to do it. But why wouldn't you, if it's for public safety, why wouldn't you want to get these changes in the system as quickly as you possibly can? Why would you want a person to have to figure out how to get down to the registry office to bring you documents when it's so critical to get it in the system so that the community be on alert? Why wouldn't you want to change your address instantly? Why wouldn't you want a new vehicle instantly? Why wouldn't you want a new employer to be reported instantly? Tell me why you wouldn't want it done electronically as quickly as possible to keep the community safe. The truth is, it doesn't keep the community safe. That's not the motivation for having all these requirements. The motivation is, I got you, and that's why they do what they do.
And that's done at the legislature level, right?
Well, yes, we fixed that legislatively here. We passed a law that says that the Department of Public Safety shall create an electronic portal for offenders to report changes, required changes. They have not created that since July 1st, 2013.
But they're required by law. So then do you just lock up the whole department for not creating it?
Well, we spend a lot of time on something that I don't think we can resolve here. But hopefully this new administration we have will actually choose to follow the law. The prosecutor that held the office for 8 years, Susana Martinez, didn't see fit to follow the law. She said, her people said, we're not going to mollycoddle these people, and they know what they got to do. We're not going to send these letters out, remind them it's time to renew. We're not going to do anything. But the point of this guy in Illinois was, if they had such a system, then the community arguably would be safer, because the information would be in the system and the community wouldn't be spending $47,000 a year to incarcerate a man and to take it away and possibly put his family on public assistance. To me, this seems like counterproductive public policy, as best I can see.
No, I totally understand. I'm just like, but what are the consequences? It seems like, you know, hey, a law gets created that the government has to follow, and then somebody just flips the bird and says, "No, we're not doing that." What are the consequences?
Well, there are none.
I don't understand. If I mess up, there are consequences for me messing up. Why do they get some sort of different set of standards?
Well, somebody was standing to challenge us. I'm not on the registry. I can't challenge the fact that they didn't create the what they were supposed to do. But someone with standing has to. I mean, we've gotten a lot of cases dismissed for various things that they haven't done since 2013, okay. Like sending out the notice. That's one consequence is you lose cases. But the other consequence okay. is that the community is not safe as the community could be if we were actually following the law. Which was designed to enhance public safety, which is what you say you want. That's why you have this stupid scheme. Right.
That's fascinating.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatters@yourtreatmentclass, about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, in Arizona, this is kind of funny. So there was a bill that was going to go through. It was House Bill 2613 that was going to improve the lives of registrants to some degree. And I really love whenever I read anything that has Maricopa County in it, because I think of pink underwear. But the guy that introduced the bill has some sex crime allegations and a plea deal kind of thing from back in the early 80s. So because those two things are sort of tangentially related, the bill won't go through now. They won't even introduce the bill because it's like too toxic at this point. Have you experienced anything like that in your political career?
Well, the bill was introduced and it was moving. It just stopped moving.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. Right.
So the legislation that would make more people eligible to have their names removed from Arizona registry and end up being a casualty because of the allegations led David Stringer to resign from the Arizona House of Representatives. But the bill has been, this reminds me of the California tiering removal process. This legislation has gotten so contaminated by all the victims' advocates and law enforcement that in some ways it's actually making the situation worse. People that would be eligible, for example, under the existing removal process, now have to wait till they're 35 years old had this bill not died. So they actually raise the requirements in some cases. This is an example of when you get all the people at the table and then you listen more to law enforcement than you do anybody else, you end up with bad legislation. But this bill here, from the folks I've talked to in Arizona, they said that it would do very little for anybody.
Okay. So then ultimately, it's not really that big a deal that it has stopped.
It's not that big a deal, but it doesn't bode well for future reform if something dies that easily, because the guy was adjudicated, I guess, decades ago, and then he had his stuff expunged and he was fully restored. And I think it's out of the state of Maryland, if I remember right.
Correct.
His 1983 in Maryland. So 35, 36 years ago. Well, certainly we can't forget about that.
I know. And I mean, he looks older than dirt. He could have still been like 60 years old when this happened in Maryland. he looks pretty old, and I'm being kind of a jerk, but sexual abuse with a minor who is at least 15 years. No, that's not even right. These were very, I don't want to rehash the guy's crime and all that, but have you seen that this happens like this where someone has some sort of, I mean, pretty far in the past, checkered past, and that stops a bill from moving?
I can't say that I've seen that, but I don't find it to be that unusual to me. That would be, it wouldn't be shocking to me that why would we want your bill to move? They would call him. You're a pedophile.
Yeah.
And he ended up resigning. Yeah.
All right. From NPR and from this would be WHYY, I think is where Terry Gross comes out of. And it's called Fresh Air. And she did a big, long interview. I didn't get a chance to listen to it. But in reading the text, the title is Charged, explains how prosecutors and plea bargains drive mass incarceration. And you've covered this on a number of occasions, that if we wanted to stop having mass incarcerations, the prosecutors could just stop, and the problem would go away. And we've seen this from the Philadelphia. I've lost the DA's name up there, or the Attorney General. No, DA,
yeah,
DA, right?
Yep.
Larry Krasner, is that right?
Something like that.
And you know, we have little over 2 million people locked up in the United States, and we could make it go away almost overnight if our DAs would just stop prosecuting everybody for all of the things. There was something super interesting in there that I wanted to get your thoughts on. It says, and with mandatory minimums, it's set up that prosecutors to be able to determine the punishment by the charge they bring in. And so we're still still living with that change, even though the crime rate has really fallen since that time. So prosecutors will change the charges to try and then get the time that they want.
No.
So you are accused of some sort of larceny, and they want you to go to prison for life. So they turn it into Grand Theft Auto with weapons and all this stuff just to try and to get you off the street for X period of time.
Well, prosecutors have usually when you engage in criminality, there would be the opportunity to select more than one charge. Very few people just do one particular thing on one particular day. When you're engaging in criminality, there's a good chance you've committed multiple crimes, even if it's something as simple as tampering with evidence in addition to your base crime. But you often have multiple counts, or it might be the difference between the severity level of a first or second degree. And the prosecutors will often charge you with the more serious offenses with the intent of getting you to plea as leverage. So, well, maybe I can't convict him of that, but maybe I can. Maybe my jury will find him guilty if he takes rolls the dice and goes to trial. But there's a methodology of how long they want you to go away for. Prosecutors will say he needs to spend 2 years in prison. He's got to plead something that'll make sure he does at least 2 years. That's not abnormal. He needs to spend 6 years in prison. So that
sounds so counterintuitive to me what it feels like the intent is. So I don't know. And that again, the incentive structure is wrong. The incentive structure is that the DA has to go out and get convictions, so he goes and gets them however he can get them, instead of actually performing equal justice. And if the person is literally innocent, hey, stop charging the person that you, so you can just get a conviction from somebody. I'm so deeply bothered by this.
Well, now you don't think a prosecutor would charge an innocent person, do you?
I know that we have a significant number of people that have been exonerated for various reasons. So yeah, I'm pretty sure that happens.
Do you think they knowingly charge an innocent person?
Well, we've also covered the I can never say that word first go around. Prosecutorial misconduct where they withhold evidence. So it probably happens in a significant minority of situations, but they do withhold evidence to incarcerate somebody to get justice for the victim from some side, but not necessarily the right person.
Well, I'm putting on my Jones colored glasses right now.
Inside joke, right?
I would not. A prosecutor deliberately prosecuting someone that they know is innocent, I've not seen a lot of that I can think of. I believe that they believe in their heart, based on what the police have told them, because the police do such fine work, thorough job, that they think that the person did it. And then that they get in their desire to put that person away to get justice, because they've got the media hounding them. They've got the victim's advocate hounding them. They've got the family. They've got the friends of the important people saying, we've got to put this guy away. They sometimes become overzealous and skirt the rules of ethical conduct to secure conviction. But I just don't know that I can say that I believe that they're saying, I know he's innocent, but by golly, I'm going to do everything I can do to put this person away. I don't believe that that's rampant. It does it happen? Possibly, but I don't believe that's rampant that happens. So, like I say, it could be.
Just in the last couple of weeks, we covered the article where the prosecutor was saying, "Yes, I totally understand that the fingerprints don't match," but the victim was saying, "I totally remember that person. Yeah, I know the fingerprints don't match, and nothing of this evidence lines up, but that guy did it because the victim said he did it."
Well, could it be that he felt that he did do it? Could it be that he felt that the lab got it wrong? Could it be that he was in good faith prosecuting that person? If you've got somebody,
you've totally flipped to the other side now.
No,
Larry.
I'm not on the other side at all. I'm saying,
I know.
I'm saying
I know.
That I don't know that I'm ready to throw all prosecutors and say that they normally prosecute innocent people. Now, that's not to say that they don't prosecute innocent people. Yes, they do prosecute innocent people.
Right.
Because the system breaks down, and people who did shabby investigations caused the system to break down. But I don't believe prosecutors come to work and say, "Well, I've got 30 cases on my desk today, yeah. and I know at least 10 of them are innocent. But by golly, we're going to put these people away." I just don't believe that. If we get to that point where they're intentionally prosecuting innocent people that they know are innocent, and they're doing that, then we might as well scrap our entire system.
Right. But what do you? I mean, like someone like Arpaio. They have such an extreme view of anybody that is accused of a crime, and they take it to the umpteenth degree of going after them with, you know, even Jeff Sessions, he said, "Man, make sure all of my attorney generals in all the states, I want you to prosecute to the fullest extent of the law."
Well, that's different than prosecuting an innocent person. We're talking about willfully prosecuting an innocent person.
I know. But we also have to have that standard in there. You can't lock up innocent people either. So you would have to err on the side of caution.
You should. But that's not where public opinion is. Public opinion is that the police are understaffed, overworked, not enough of them, and that if they turn over a case for prosecution, by golly, it's a solid case. Because they have so much to do that they would never, ever go after some low-level petty criminal. And they would not have a vendetta. And the average person doesn't believe that police have vendettas, so that they're overstaffed and that they have more resources than you could ever imagine. But a prosecutor violating ethical rules in terms of not complying with discovery, not giving a witness list in time, playing fast and loose so that a person doesn't get a chance to interview a witness prior to trial, that's not the same thing. It's wrong. But that's not the same thing as knowing that the person's innocent and doing it anyway. That's a person who's breaking the rules, like deflating footballs, trying to win a game. They're trying to win the game.
What about fill in the blank for any minority or a different group of people? So racial minorities, the gay community. Do you think there were people that were literally trying to go after those people and maybe still trying to go after those people?
Within the system, yes, there are people who are deliberately targeting minorities for harassment, and there are people who are deliberately targeting gay and transgender for harassment. Absolutely. But I'm not convinced that the people sat around and made the laws. That's where with my more liberal friends, I disagree. They think that all across the country that people converged in these secret meetings and they said, "How are we going to pass laws that's going to get more homosexuals?" I'm not convinced that they did that.
You think the law was written in a neutral fashion for race, gender, all that stuff? It's just how we, the people, have then gone after it.
Not entirely. I believe that it's like testing. Standardized testing have biases built into them that tend to favor those who come from a more the more life experience and exposure you have, the more rounded individual, the more you're gonna have life experience to do well on standardized tests. So I believe that the people who made these laws, being that the privileged generally tend to be making the laws, I believe that they're going to be making laws more that are in tune with their life. But I don't believe they sat there and said, "Well, you know, we got to make sure we keep the people that are the have-nots down. How can we lock more of these savages up?" I don't believe that conversation took place. you know, I'd like to be proven wrong. But I believe the result is that happens. People get harassed by the police because they're black. People get harassed by the police because of a number of reasons. People get substandard service from the police because of a number of reasons. But I don't believe the Albuquerque City Council of the 9 councilors, I don't believe because the Albuquerque Police Department has had jerks running it for some time that the 9 city councilors deliberately sought to have that as the outcome. I don't believe that.
Right. Right. And I'm sure that I can interpret that as, generally speaking, the vast majority, you don't believe that they were doing it. But there are cases where people do it.
No, I believe that the Albuquerque Police Department is filled with jerks and that they're doing a lot of bad things. But I don't believe that the policymakers who fund the police department,
yeah,
the 9 city councilors, I don't believe they converged outside of council chambers and said, how can we have the most obnoxious police department that goes around and harasses gays and harasses black people and blah, blah, blah. I don't believe they did that. I believe what happened was that lax oversight, poor training, poor selection of who's leading the department, the command staff, resulted in a culture of discriminatory practices and over-harsh policing. But I don't believe that was a conspiracy by the city council to affect that outcome.
Right, 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 right. Interesting, interesting, interesting. Well, tell me this. Do you want to cover the decision or do you want to go to the Pennsylvania thing?
Well, aren't they the same? No, they're not the same. Duh. See, I told you I have old timers.
I'm like, man, I sure don't want to ask you that. No, that was from Massachusetts, right?
Yeah.
Do you wanna go over you only sent this to me like 10 seconds before we started recording, so I have no experience with this Commonwealth versus Felix the Cat.
I don't understand why 15 seconds before airtime is not sufficient.
What? And actually, it's not even Felix. It's Feliz. F-E-L-I-Z. Feliz. Feliz. Feliz.
Well, what is the problem with your prep time? 15 seconds is not sufficient?
I'm not a speed reader, man.
Well,
come on.
Well, we receive...
If there were a summary, I could go over that part.
We received this Thursday. I did from Hank. And thank you, Hank, for, as always, for sending good stuff to us. And it's a decision regarding... GPS monitoring in this the highest court in Massachusetts, and we're beginning to see a building body of case law on GPS monitoring and the excessive use of it, and this is another one to add to the arsenal of what they're doing in Massachusetts is requiring, if you have a particular type of conviction, the statute requires the GPS. It's a statutory requirement, and there's no particularized findings. And this decision, building on the Supreme Court's decision and Grady, U.S. Supreme Court's decision in North Carolina, the Grady decision, and then subsequently North Carolina courts applied Grady to say that you needed to have an individualized finding. This is basically mimicking what they did in North Carolina, saying that if you're going to put a GPS on a person, that there has to be a particularized, there has to be a process, they have to be afforded due process and given a particularized findings of why that's necessary. So this could result in, I think they said, 3,900 people on GPS monitoring in Massachusetts. This could result in a significant diminishment of that of the number of people being monitored by GPS that are under supervision. It's a great day for it's not such a good day to be in the GPS business though. But it's a great day for the offenders who are just arbitrarily having these things attached to their bodies. And I resent saying you have to wear it. You don't wear it. You put your watch on in the morning and you wear it. You put your clothes on. But a GPS is attached to you. It's not something that you take on and off each day.
We could go back in the archive, and we did an interview with one of our listeners that had GPS monitoring, and she said that it left like an indentation. I mean, I guess, you know, like if you wear a ring for a long period of time, you end up with like a little cutout in your finger. So she was saying that the leg monitor left indentations. It gets irritated underneath it. There's all kinds of just garbage things. And so GPS monitoring does that for you, which is awesome.
Well, we had a similar decision out of the Georgia Supreme Court. On GPS monitoring. And this, like I said, there's a building body of case law on GPS monitoring. And being the techie person that you are that believes that tech's the answer to everything, this is probably crushing to you to see that they're not able to just willy-nilly put these devices on people because that's what they do. And that's the downside to all this tech. It sounds good. we're going to have fewer people in prison. But all it does is really expand the universe of people who are under under monitoring, and it makes your it curtails your liberty. But the Massachusetts Supreme Court said that you these people are going to get hearings, and they're going to get due process, and it's a great thing. And it actually is Feliz Commonwealth versus Feliz.
Yeah, Feliz. Yep. Feliz Navidad. So it's Christmas. Mm-hmm. It's Christmas in Massachusetts in this decision.
And we can give a shout out to Eric Tennant, who was involved in the case, who's an Arsenal connection attorney. He's spoken at our conferences, at least a couple, one or two of
okay.
them. He's been with us.
Before my time, I believe.
Well, if you say so.
I mean, it wasn't in the Atlanta or the Ohio conferences. No,
it was in Dallas. It was in Dallas.
Ah, see, before my time. Mm-hmm. Before my time. Is there anything else that we need to know about this bill? Is there anything else that you want to go over? I know it's like, what, 60 pages and you read most of it?
I skim read it and it's 36 pages and I made a few highlights in it like I did last week that people might want to look at. So we're going to attach it to the show notes, right?
I will do that for sure. I will do that. Oh, and you know, let me cover that. You pointed out, I totally forgot. I didn't stop making time markings. I was just, you know, I edited the podcast on Sunday and I said, God, this didn't take me nearly as long. And then a couple of days later, you said, hey, where are the time markings? You didn't put those on anymore? I'm like, just forgot. There's also a transcript that I do, and that'll last week's episode will get uploaded here in a few minutes. So I just forgot. So there's a reminder also, if you want a transcript of the thing, you can get that too, of the podcast. Pretty much every episode I get a transcription done.
But you have old timers from time to time.
It does happen. It does happen. I get too involved with so many other things and rush through and I don't have a checklist and so forth.
Well, I guess one other point to make on this is that since the U.S. Supreme Court said that beyond all doubt, they said, I think per curiam, I think all nine justices said GPS monitoring is clearly a search. So the question is whether the search is supported, if it's a justifiable search. All searches are not illegal, but they have to be supported by probable cause. So the U.S. Supreme Court had expressed dubiosity about what North Carolina was doing. And this makes it clear, as far as the Massachusetts Supreme Court, is that although you have a diminished expectation of liberty when you're under probation, it says, and I think this is on page 21, nevertheless, the government does not have an unlimited ability to infringe upon a probationer's still existing, albeit diminished, expectations of privacy. And that's highlighted on page 21. So it's worthy of considering that, yes, you have a diminished expectation, but the de facto, and then also the state hung its hat on that they had people sign their contract saying that they agreed to this. So you got put on probation. You walked across to the probation department and they said, sign this contract. And they said on that same page, the fact that the defendant signed a probation contract acceding to the statutorily mandated condition of GPS monitoring does not change our constitutional analysis. Basically, you can't force people under duress to sign away their constitutional rights. And it says further, the coercive quality of the circumstances in which the defendant seeks to avoid incarceration by obtaining probation on certain conditions makes principles of voluntary waiver and consent generally inapplicable. So this has got good stuff in it. And like I said, I've highlighted a few things in there that are relevant. So if they just go page through it, look for the highlights, that'll narrow down some of the points of the case.
And you said something earlier, and I want you to cover it again. If you said that we're building a body of case law against, I think, you know, going like of all these different expansions of registration requirements and restrictions. Can you go over that again?
Well, we're building the registry is one of the things that we'd like to see end, but that's not going to happen in one fell swoop. But we're building incrementally towards dismantling various parts of the apparatus. The GPS monitor, the beast of GPS, is being contained. The beast of polygraphing with forcing people to confess to incriminate themselves. That beast is being contained, albeit much slower pace. But the beast of residency and proximity restrictions is being turned back. I mean, we're getting ready to hopefully attack the two sheriffs in Georgia who found it upon themselves to impose a signage requirement on Halloween. As the body of case law expands, it makes it easier to win because each time there's a decision that gets cited to in other decisions, if you read this decision out of Massachusetts, they cite to South Carolina, North Carolina, the U.S. Supreme Court, to the body of case law that helps them come to their decision. So, and now we've got another highest court of the state of Massachusetts, we can throw in the mix when we do another case right. about GPS monitoring. We can say, and Massachusetts saw it the same way. So the body of case law is building in terms of the excesses of the registry.
Outstanding.
But the silver bullet is not there. I always make myself unpopular when I tell people there's no magic silver bullet going in the registry.
Well, speaking of that, then here we are with the Pennsylvania situation where they kind of struck down the registry and they're going to try and come back around and take another bite of the apple. This article is from the Collateral Consequences Resource Center. And this is the title of the article is "The Pennsylvania High Court Will Review Sex Offender Registration." That last number I heard was something like 17,000 people were going to come off the registry. And I think we've played clips from various politicians along the way that are like, "We can't lose track of all of these people," and so they're going to do it again, aren't they?
Well, this is a sort of a different a slant. This is the big decision in Pennsylvania was Commonwealth versus Munez, decided in 2018. And that case presented two questions of whether people committed their crimes before the adoption of the new law could be required to register without violating the constitution, state constitution's ex post facto clause. And that was the only question of the two that was answered. And then the second part was whether the law more broadly violates due process by unfairly labeling a person as sexually dangerous without first providing that fact, giving them opportunity to challenge that presumption. And so that they were able to sidestep because they were able to give them the relief that they were asking for by the ex post facto clause. So they didn't need to resolve that due process question. So everybody going forward in Pennsylvania is registering under the three-tiered system with all the more onerous requirements. They just decided that they could not be applied to the previous class of people, the group of people that predated it. So now there's a post-Munez challenge about the this guy saying, yeah, it's real nice that my offense is a tier three and I have all these restrictions, but you have not afforded me an individualized due process. So this is going to answer that question. And Aaron Marcus, who's with the Philadelphia Defender Association, he's been on at least a couple of our Arsenal in Action conference calls. He is the one who authored this, and he's intimately involved in this. And he says he doesn't believe that they'll be able to dodge the question in the current round of litigation. They're going to have to answer the question of whether an individualized determination is made about each offender. And if they answer that in the affirmative that they are entitled to a due process, this basically guts the damn registry because they have to spend a whole lot of money to give everybody due process.
Right. What will they do? What will they do to speed up that, to make that more efficient? Will they just like, hey, here's 10,000 people, let them go?
That would be what I would recommend if I were in the legislature. I would say, well, we're not going to have 17,000 or 50, whatever it is, of due process hearings. And it would be the people who have been convicted. They said they're adding 1,500 a year. So this law passed in 2010, became effective in 2012. So you're looking at several thousand people. We're not going to do that many hearings. So it would almost behoove you to roll back the registry to at least the last time it was held to be constitutional. And that would be the way to avoid if the court finds that they're entitled to a due process is to roll back to a less punitive version, but which basically neuters the Pennsylvania registry.
Right.
Compared to what
they have, they call it like SORNA 1 and 2, don't they? And maybe SORNA 3 too, right?
Well, they have only one version now. Well, they actually have that's not correct because they've got the pre SORNA, but when they adopted the Adam Walsh Act, they have that three-tiered system, and people after 2012 are subject to these enhanced requirements. And the people who predated that have gotten relief, and that's the ones the state are trying. They're trying to figure out a new registry for them because they don't want to let them go. So they're trying to figure out how to keep those people registered in some capacity. And they can do it very easily. They can put them on a non-punitive registry, take their picture off the internet, tell them to mail in a form once a year, and tell them to come in every 3 years and have their picture updated. That would probably be constitutional. But all this shit that they try to require people is too much. That makes it far more than a regulatory scheme. So if you want an if you want to have a constitutional registry, you're going to have to peel the onion way back.
You're going to have to basically go back to what Alaska had back in the day.
Back in the day, yes.
Which is where all these shenanigans start of no driver, like, I mean, because just like driver's license, not driver's license, so license plates and all that, just it's just so silly. With what benefit other than it's some sort of happy, happy feel good? God, I could go down a rabbit trail on where I think that might come from too, but I won't go there.
I think that it would be a good time to have Aaron be joining us on the Narsil in Action or on a podcast. Because
maybe both. I think we should do that.
Because he's a basket of knowledge that I don't possess on Pennsylvania. I've got the basic knowledge, but I mean, he knows this stuff intimately.
Sure. And does Commonwealth have anything, any difference? Is it just a distinction in name only? There's what, three or four states that are Commonwealths? Is there a difference there?
I don't know. I think we need to unmute the a person from Maryland and see if she can explain it.
She may revolt if I do this. Brenda, can you speak to any differences with the Commonwealth? Is there something such a thing? Uh oh. Yeah, she wants to remain quiet. All right. So, well, you can play not nice with me then.
So, yeah.
I will see you at the conference. How's that?
There went your pay.
I know, right? Well, that's all we got on this show. There is something coming up on next Thursday, so a week, almost 2 weeks from here we are recording. What's going on?
Well, Narsil in Action, after having several months of no conference calls, we're gonna do one on the 27th of April at 7 Eastern time, and we're gonna be talking about a fabulous decision out of Illinois regarding the keeping people in prison after they've served their time. And that's
just what we covered last week on the podcast, but you're going to have the attorney on, right?
We're going to have one of the attorneys on. We're going to have Adele Nicholas, and that's a litigation machine. Her and Mark Weinberg, they've filed a number of actions. Some have been successful, some have not, but they are doing jam up quality legal work. And they got a great decision out of a district court, Northern District of Illinois, that Illinois's, they call it mandatory supervised release, which is similar to the federal system. You serve your time, and then you go into a period by statute that where you have to be under supervision. And that period of mandatory supervised release, if you don't present an address that's approvable by the Prisoner Review Board, the Department of Corrections hangs on to you. And that just doesn't pass constitutional muster to incarcerate someone for a crime that they've already served their time for just because they don't have money. And so that decision is going to be unpacked in a little bit more detail. But it has ramifications. I know some people believe that things only when you get to the state border, it stops. But that has ramifications right. For my state as well. We have an almost identical system to what they have in Illinois. We call it parole, but it really isn't, because in this state, you have to serve all your time, less any credit for good time. And then you go into a period of mandatory supervised release, except we call it parole, and it's 5 to 20 or 5 to life. And our parole board is the one who affixes those conditions, and they affix the approval on your certificate of parole based on you having an address that meets the requirements. And they have so many limitations, not by statute, but by policy, where you can't live, that they end up hanging on to people. So we're looking at litigating using the same theories that they did. Now that they've done the heavy lifting, we can come in and use the same arguments and make the same claims here. And there are other states out there, so it does extend beyond Illinois. It should be interesting to you no matter what state you're in. Now, those states where you get an indeterminate sentence, where you're sentenced to be in prison from 10 to 30 years, that's not the same analysis, because you have not served all your time there. When they grant you a conditional release and you've still got 20 years on in the state after you've met the 10-year minimum, they can hang on to you for up to the period of the entire 30 years. So it's incumbent upon you to try to find a reintegration facility of some type so you can be released. But when you've done all your time, we need to turn that key and let you out no matter where you're going, because you should be a free person, and we should let you go.
All right. Well, while you're talking to the attorney, I'm going to be pushing all the buttons and sliding all the things and making everything work to connect everybody and doing the live stream. So it's a team effort.
It should be a great program, and I think it'll be worth your while to tune in and listen to it.
And that's next Thursday. What date and at what time?
Remind us. The 27th at 7 Eastern time, and it's slated to be a two-hour program, although it can expand because I'm looking at adding another topic. So it's possibly going to expand.
Outstanding. Well, very good.
And how do people support us here at the podcast and contact us?
We would adore it. Share it with all of the people. Share it far and wide, trying to grow the numbers. I would rather have more people download and listen to it than any other metric, but share it far and wide. But if you feel compelled to give a contribution, feel free to head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. $1 a month is amazing and greatly appreciated. We love our Patreon supporters, and totally, like, it is inspiration for us to keep doing the show, because there, you know, we can go out to dinner a couple times a month, and you know, just makes life a little easier.
It does. And we're going to grow this thing to 1,000 patrons within the year. So
within the year, what are you, nuts? Wow.
Well, aren't we at 30?
Hey man,
aren't we at 30?
Go big or go home, right?
35 now.
We are at 36.
All right. So why can't we be at 1,000 within a year?
Because it's April, almost May. Well, that leaves not very many months to get a whole trove of people.
Well, I was
Though,
joking on the
again,
thousand.
There are 800,000 of us.
I was joking, but I would like to be at 100. I mean, shouldn't we be able to find 100 people?
Grow 30 people per quarter shouldn't be insurmountable. So tell people to visit us. I did some postings over on what's it called, Reddit. Somebody had asked a question that I thought was appropriate for me to make a response, and then I also then plugged the podcast. Somebody came behind me and said, hey, come over to Discord. So somebody in here, one of our 40 or 50 people that are on Discord, then followed me up and then cross-posted, which was pretty neat. I don't know who did that. So Reddit has you could go post on Reddit, send people to the Registry Matters website at registrymatters.co. And your favorite medium is the telephone.
Absolutely.
747-227-4477.
Let's make sure we get that number, because we didn't get a phone call this week, and I need a phone call every episode.
747-227-4477.
And we've gotten some really good calls lately.
We have. And I shouldn't even say this, but somebody did call. I just didn't play it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So there's that. I have those powers. I censored. So shoot me.
Well, I have a feeling it probably went too long, or was not audio broadcast quality, or one of the two, or both.
Yeah. And so with that, Larry, that's all I got. And I so very much appreciate it. And I hope you have a great night.
Well, thanks everyone for the, we've got a full house in Discord right now.
There is a full house of Discord, and there's a lot of chatter. It's hard to keep up with.
So there's dozens of them in there.
There are a lot.
So
have a great night, Larry, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks. Good night.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us here at FYP, and we hope you will join us again on our next broadcast.